As Marian is suggesting, the way in which we interpret and pursue the ethos of our faith tradition is a fundamental aspect of our stewardship. I think that is indeed what you're suggesting, Marian. Now, stewardship has to do with taking care of ourselves, taking care of each other, taking care of creation. So stewardship involves taking care of that on which we base our very existence. As human beings, our lives depend on certain things. We need an adequate and healthy supply of food in order to survive and to thrive. And in that department, good stewardship means taking care of the source or sources of our food so that we can live and be healthy. Some people depend on their own farm for their food. They look after that farm with utmost care and responsibility. For us, living in an urban, cosmopolitan society, the stewardship of our food supply is more complex, and we have to exercise that stewardship through the support of a healthy economy with regulations that encourage and monitor an adequate food supply, efficient distribution, and quality control. We can make similar observations about the other things on which our lives depend: drinking water, transportation, education, healthcare. All of these require good stewardship. But our lives and everything that we depend on, the quality of life, is related as well to the attitudes that we have, the good character we try to develop, the sound wisdom that we draw upon. And our stewardship of such relatively intangible items is also very important. People of faith generally see such stewardship as being most important. And that's why I think we call ourselves people of faith. Now, one way of identifying good stewardship is to contrast it with poor stewardship, which can be done rather easily because there's a lot of bad stewardship happening in our world. Throwing garbage out onto the streets, toxic waste into our rivers and oceans, greenhouse gases into our atmosphere. We can see that this is bad stewardship. And we can develop then alternatives which are not as harmful, not harmful at all if possible, thereby moving in the direction of good stewardship. And when it comes to those intangibles that I mentioned a moment ago, we can also see a contrast between the good and the bad. And the Bible, by the way, is fond of presenting us with pictures of those kinds of contrasts. In our epistle reading today, we are presented with a contrast between those who are asleep at the wheel and drunk on the job, and those who are paying attention, wide awake, sober, and appropriately dressed for the task at hand. And we might just follow up a bit from the time with the children and reflect a little bit about this mandate of being dressed properly for daily living in the way of Christ. This injunction comes up a number of times in the Christian scriptures, the idea that in order to be prepared for virtuous living, we need to put on the gifts of the Spirit, just like we put on our clothing when we get up in the morning. And this is all in keeping with the exercise of good personal stewardship. Have a shower, get dressed, eat a healthy breakfast, brush your teeth, and don't neglect to put on some courage, some patience, some generosity, some love, and so on. We can't live a good life without that spiritual wardrobe. And when we neglect these items, our stewardship is on a slippery slope, and abundant life will slip away. So that's the right use of the language of slipping, I hope. Now, this biblical metaphor of the wardrobe, albeit somewhat intangible, is fairly easy, I think, to understand. But when we delve more deeply into our stewardship of intangibles, things become a bit more subtle. Along with personal spiritual stewardship, we also have a responsibility for the health and well-being of our communal ethos, the faith tradition itself. And in order to help us think about good stewardship in our faith tradition, it might, again, be helpful to find an example of bad stewardship in this regard. As in the previous cases, bad stewardship is characterized by carelessness and neglect. When a faith tradition is neglected, it is left to fester in a cauldron of flawed assumptions, misrepresentations, and stereotypes that are readily adopted as the popular religion of careless participants within the tradition and readily batted about by uncaring observers outside of the faith tradition. And this is, to a substantial degree, what is happening with our Christian faith in contemporary society. Many on the inside are carelessly cultivating platitudes and ignorantly endorsing theological nonsense on the pretext of being true believers, while many on the outside are happily lapping up the nonsense on the pretext of doing some homework and getting to know what the Christian faith is all about. For example, when the media want an opinion from a Christian perspective, who do they turn to? These days, it is unlikely that they will consult the moderator of the United Church or the general secretary of the Canadian Council of Churches. They're more likely to turn to Dr. Charles McVetti, the president of the so-called Canada Christian College, who will, and always does, feed them a pile of nonsense that reeks of the sort of superstition and fundamentalism of which we should all be deeply ashamed. Now, some will say that we in the United Church have brought this situation onto ourselves. We don't go around shouting to the world that we are true Christian believers. So why would anyone come to us for an opinion? Could also be the case, of course, that we have nowhere near the entertainment value that Mr. McVetti's outrageous statements have in an increasingly secular world. In any case, I'm trying to make a point about the travesty that results from bad stewardship of a faith tradition in order to get us thinking about what good stewardship might look like. To begin with, good stewardship means that we are willing to be in conversation with the wisdom of our faith tradition. Having a conversation is a two-way street. When a faith tradition has been in existence for many centuries, there is a tendency for its wisdom to be perceived as being static and designed to be passed down in a one-way process. In that case, our job would be simply to receive the wisdom of our tradition in whatever package it is delivered to us and sign our acknowledgement of receipt upon delivery. But that, my friends, is not good stewardship. It would be like burying our treasure in the ground. It would mean that there would be no engagement with the wisdom which in our faith tradition is a living entity. No wonder the person in our gospel parable today was so angry with the servant who buried his talent in the ground. What a waste. Here was an opportunity to participate in abundant living, and it was thrown away. Now, speaking of that gospel parable and all the other bits of the teaching of Jesus that we have in the Bible, this is all part of that wisdom which invites us into conversation. We cannot and must not assume that the package in which that wisdom appears to be delivered to us has only one obvious and supposedly true interpretation. After all, it has been manipulated by biblical interpreters since the time it was written down, and before that, it was manipulated in the earliest storytelling of the tradition and then by the gospel authors themselves who actually wrote the material down. So if we want to get a sense of the wisdom that is wrapped up within the package we have received, then we need to do a bit of digging, and even then we need to have a conversation with that living piece of wisdom that we manage to dig up. Now, after a bit of this sort of work, we're going to discover that our parable today is not at all a lesson in sharp entrepreneurship and shrewd investment, as many would say it is. Nor does the point of the parable center on the substantial profits made by the first two investors. And least of all, is this a lesson about the way God is going to reward or punish human minions in their efforts, or lack thereof, in perpetuating a Christian empire. All of these and other incorrect interpretations have run rampant along the one-way street of Christian indoctrination. Well, let's try to do some interpretation that is more in keeping with the conversation we might have with the living wisdom of our faith tradition. And remember, we get to ask lots and lots of questions in that process. So Jesus is always talking about that kingdom in this parable as well. That's what the parable's about. And if so, is this then actually a parable about raising money for the kingdom? Do we see that anywhere else in the teaching of Jesus? Does Jesus, in fact, show any interest in creating an institution and raising money for it? And when Jesus does talk about money, what is the money to be used for? What might it symbolize? Now, when we get into this kind of conversation and ask these sorts of questions, we'll find ourselves heading in directions other than that original one-way street. And to make a long story short, and because we don't have a whole lot of time right now, let me try just a summary of where we might find ourselves going. It's not surprising to hear Jesus talk about investment per se. Jesus makes a huge personal investment in the project that he calls the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus encourages everyone to do the same. Disciples, friends, passers-by, even adversaries, all are invited to invest in the kingdom. Not to make money, but to make the world a better place. Now, if we want to make the world a better place, it's wise to make investments, in people, or better, to make investments in relationships with people, in partnerships. And does money ever play a role in this? Well, of course, but not for the sake of making money from relationships with other people. And, by the way, at the same time, I think, nor should money be used just to throw at people as if to say, here is some money, it will solve your problems and fix your ills. Such charity is not in keeping with kingdom relationships either. When money is invested in relationships with people, we should honor the fundamental meaning of a word which is often used in association with money, the word credit, which is related to the Latin word credo, meaning I believe. When we share the wealth, we extend credit to each other. The money is our commonwealth. Our project is for the common good. You and I are partners. We believe in each other. We believe in each other's capacity to be good stewards of our commonwealth. Some of us have more access to wealth than others. That's simply an economic fact of life in this world of ours. We may have $5,000 or $2,000 or $1,000 to invest in the pool of our commonwealth, and if we do so in good faith, our investment can bear much fruit, not for you or for me, but for the common good. One of the wonderful aspects of genuine kingdom relationships is that we are free to exercise good faith. We're free to believe in each other. And that brings us back, I think, to Marian Pope's comments a few minutes ago and to Catherine Hawkins' missiology, which came out of her experience with people in China in whom she had believed and with whom she had discovered a vital and essential wisdom as they entered together into an authentic conversation with the source of wisdom in our faith tradition and, for that matter, in other faith traditions as well. Now, to finish these reflections, we are going to sing a hymn that sums up rather wonderfully what I've been talking about. It's a hymn about our mission, and at the same time, a hymn about the stewardship of our faith tradition. And if we manage that stewardship well, we will live with integrity the abundant life of the kingdom. And so, in the words of the hymn, we will live to God's delight. So be it. Amen.